In January, we rang in 2020 with the same optimism that we do every year. The sentiments we hear year after year of good health and success were spread amongst our networks. However, no one knew what was about to hit us. Like many fourth-year students, I was preparing to finish my undergraduate degree at Wilfrid Laurier University, excited for what the possibilities of the future held. However, instead of being met with potential opportunities, the world was met with a global pandemic that came into full effect in Canada by March. Hi, I'm Amelia Mola-Schmidt, and you're listening to In Conversation with Radio Laurier, a podcast where we talk to various professionals on the COVID-19 epidemic and how it is affecting our local communities and world. Misinformation and conspiracy theories are words that we seem to be hearing more often than usual these days. Today, it seems to be increasingly difficult to find information on the COVID-19 epidemic that doesn't have an agenda, which makes it more difficult for citizens to make informed decisions on their daily actions. Joining us today on the program is an associate professor in the Department of Communication Studies at Wilfrid Laurier University, whose research specializes in studying pandemics, Dr. Penelope Ironstone. Dr. Ironstone's research spans from cultural studies of health and medicine, risk cultures, cultural theory, and feminist and queer media studies. Dr. Ironstone joined us to answer our questions about the pandemic, misinformation, anxiety culture, and conspiracy theories. Here's what she had to say. Dr. Ironstone, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a bit about your research on previous public health crises?
I actually have been working on and thinking about pandemics since the 1980s. I was an undergraduate student when the AIDS pandemic really started to affect areas outside of the United States, and particularly San Francisco and New York. And so as a young undergraduate, I was watching as people were very fearful, as my gay friends were really trying to engage what was going on there. And I really saw it as sort of an opportunity to be thinking about the relationship between our intellectual worlds and the sort of the practice worlds of that we live in. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that I was going to be thinking about AIDS and AIDS activism and thinking about this as a public health crisis, because we have to remember the AIDS crisis in the early days. You know, physicians refused to treat people, hospitals refused to have people coming in. There was a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And so at this period, as I really started to think about some of the stakes of the world of diseases and of microbes that we live with, right, and the mm-hmm. social, cultural, political, and economic ramifications of them, there was a big assumption that this was a pandemic that was affecting only the gay community. And as we know, as time has marched on, we've seen that it actually is a global pandemic that affects all sorts of people, but in unequal ways. Mm-hmm. Now, when I went on to do my PhD, I was thinking a lot about these social, cultural, political, and economic ramifications mm-hmm. of the AIDS crisis, and thinking in particular about what it means to have experienced such substantial loss. Right. We have to remember, you know, right to this day, you know, over 30 million people have died of AIDS globally. Mm-hmm. And in the early stages, a lot of them were in North America. And in North America, we have to think about it at this time, it was a lot of hubris, right? We're going to program out all diseases. Antibiotics are helping us to do these things. And in 1979, they had actually gotten a vaccine for smallpox. They'd eradicated it. And they thought, this is the new brave world. AIDS arrived on the scene as a big surprise. Mm-hmm. And in North America, you know, North America, where we have this luxury of greater access to healthcare, greater access to sort of political will when it comes to medicine, we recognize it in different ways, particularly in Canada as a human right. When we see this vast amount of loss, and really a generation of gay men in the United States were wiped out. Mm-hmm. But thinking about this in the context of the trauma of that experience and of the mourning that had to take place while people were still trying to save their own lives. So mm-hmm. my doctoral work was on the AIDS pandemic. And in 1994, they came up with a drug cocktail that turned it into something that was not a necessarily fatal disease. And people stopped sort of being interested in pandemics. I'm not going to lie. I soldiered on. I continued my research. But at this time, I was starting to see this field called emerging infectious diseases. Right. This idea that we were used to a whole series of diseases that had been sort of addressed by means of vaccination, but that new diseases seem to be emerging. And this is, of course, emerging because of the ways that we've organized ourselves in terms of our economies, in terms of formerly pristine habitats being moved into by human development, by agriculture, and so forth. So I started to see that there were other viruses that we might want to be a little bit concerned about. In the late 1990s, it was H5N1, it was the bird flu, and there were all of these alarm bells going off about the bird flu. In the 1990s also, we had a reemergence of Ebola. And Ebola had appeared for the first time to our knowledge in the 1970s. But in the 1990s, that there were these outbreaks that were really causing a lot of anxiety. Like, what happens if these diseases that seem to be isolated in a particular place start to emerge elsewhere? And so turning to the new millennium, I was already concerned about other kinds of viruses and what emerging infectious diseases might mean for us. So I have been sort of paying attention to the alarm that has been coming out by scientists of all stripes, by the World Health Organization, mm-hmm. about the possibility of, and this was their phrasing, the big one coming.
Yeah.
Now, when I was doing this work and doing this studying, I had no idea that COVID was on the horizon. Right. But certainly by 2003, I was living in Toronto during the SARS outbreak mm-hmm. and watching as we experienced an outbreak of something that was unprecedented, that they didn't know a lot about, that seemed to be really fatal very mm-hmm. quickly, mm-hmm. And that had come to us from by means of easy global travel and global interconnectedness from China. And so in Toronto during this period, SARS was a frightening period. People left the city in droves. It caused the city itself to suffer an economic crisis. Definitely forms of xenophobia and racism mm-hmm. as Chinatown really was like there was no one there.
Yeah.
So early 2000s, I start moving and sort of expanding a little bit. And that was right around the time that I got my job at Laurier, I have to say, that I'm that old. But then, you know, that so I started working at Laurier and I was still working on pandemics. And I was trying to think, what is it that they're saying? Well, they were saying that the next big one was going to be a flu. And I was starting to do research on something that most people didn't find terribly interesting at the time. The flu was a hard sell, I'm not going to lie. Talking to my students about the next big flu pandemic. Even when you reference or go back to 1918, 1919 mm-hmm. and the Spanish flu pandemic, which now lots of people know about, but at the time people weren't really interested in engaging to find out that approximately 50 million people died in the space of 2 years over three waves of infection, that this was something that we had been told that we were on a cycle for. Like every 50 years, there's going to be a pandemic of some sort, but how we engage it, how we are, how it affects us is going to be possibly different than the Spanish flu because it was early in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Now, go from there to 2009. 2009, we have H1N1. I don't know if you remember H1N1.
Yes, I do. I was in elementary school.
You were at elementary school. Yes. So your parents were probably very concerned. You would have been on the list for the early rollout of the vaccine than when it came out. And there was a lot of concern because otherwise healthy people were getting the flu and were coming down with symptoms that were potentially fatal. Now, viruses evolve, they change. So that turned into the pandemic that wasn't. It's famously, people are like, oh, the World Health Organization, they pulled the trigger too soon. But the lesson of this was that we really weren't prepared. Mm-hmm. We definitely weren't prepared. Now, in Canada, we became prepared because of SARS. Right. We forgot some of those lessons over mm-hmm. time. So my interest when COVID was coming on the scene, I've been paying attention, Ebola outbreaks to MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome that is related to SARS and SARS-CoV-2. Mm-hmm. So I've been paying attention to this. So my research really has spanned a gamut and of mm-hmm. lots and lots of different microbes along the line that have really told us something. And right now, as we're seeing the fault lines of the culture, of the ways we have of organizing ourselves, of our ability to really understand threats that we can't see, taste, touch, or smell, mm-hmm. and how to respond to them, and how to respond to the uncertainty that comes with them. Sorry, that was a pretty long introduction to my research.
No, that was in depth and thorough.
It covers a gamut.
No, I appreciate that. Now, just that kind of segues perfectly into what I want to ask you next. So how has your previous research kind of differed from what we are seeing now with the global crisis of COVID-19? Are there any gaps maybe that you didn't see when you were first working on other pandemics that you've really seen come to light now?
Mm-hmm. I would say that because I've been spending some time looking at the preparedness plans, and of course coming as a communication and cultural studies scholar. Yeah. So there have been great plans and rollouts for what would happen in the event of a pandemic. What happens when the World Health Organization tells us that a pandemic is imminent, or when they actually call it and say this is a pandemic?
Right.
And what surprised me, I think, first was the ways in which everyday people got up to speed really quickly.
Right.
Once we had the calls of states of emergency in the Canadian context, I would say first federally, then provincially, that we saw that people responded to this as an emergency. And I'm not going to lie, at the start, I was genuinely surprised that people would take their individual interests and put them to the side for the purposes of the collective interest, that they would tolerate the lockdown, that they would engage with the idea of the remote workplace and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to say that one of the things that is striking about this pandemic, this is not the first social media pandemic.
Right. Okay.
Right? H1N1 was.
Yeah.
And truly a pandemic. It was global. But this one has been filled with so much information that there's been such a saturation of information. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it did feed into my pre-existing research, which was very concerned for the stakes of anxiety and what happens if we just whip up anxiety around events without actually having concrete steps for people to engage, to be able to manage the anxiety in their worlds. I was concerned with, for example, spectacularization that was taking place in the news media. And I think that, you know, when you look at the history of, for example, most recently 2016 and Ebola, we can admit that it was like that there was some tremendous spectacularization that was happening, anxiety that was sparked about the first case in the United States, the different ways of presenting and framing the information of an outbreak that we should be concerned about, but the ways that people seem to panic in the North American context, and that concerned me a lot. Now, I have to say that in the Canadian context with COVID-19, we had this incredible attempt to be careful, to provide care based on criticisms of, for example, the CBC's response to the Ebola outbreak in 2016, where this idea is we need to be more responsible. We can't just freak people out without giving them something else, and that we lose trust and trustworthiness the more we spectacularize. So how is it that we can actually engage this information, which is cause for concern, is frightening, is uncertain, is out of our control, and how is it we can engage that in a responsible way? And Andre Picard of the Globe and Mail was pretty fantastic. He's one of the few full-time health beat journalists in Canada. And he was very concerned, for example, about this, the idea of the rolling death counts.
Right.
Like, what information do people get from that, apart from be very, very worried?
Mm-hmm.
He was concerned with the ways that the language that was being used, the way that, for example, in the early stages, particularly in the US press and the UK press, where the word fear is one of the most present words, more than outbreak, more than pandemic, the word fear, everybody's afraid. Doctors are afraid, the World Health Organization is afraid, public health is afraid, journalists are afraid that they're making people afraid, everybody's afraid, right? So one of the things that we can think about is that I think that what surprised me was that kind of attempt to be responsible, and I'm not sure that it was totally successful, and I think that that's partly because we are in a socially mediated world where a lot of our news is not local, it is not Canadian. So that was a surprise to me, was that the attempt to sort of rein this in and to try to engage it differently. But I think that the biggest thing that has surprised me is a kind of social, cultural, and even economic resilience. that I did not anticipate. If you look at movies like Contagion, and I know this is like right now it's on the top
bestseller. It's trending on Netflix.
Oh, it's totally, it is that and Outbreak. And I have to say, neither of these are good models for imagining, but we do tend to watch popular culture. Like we engage it in a way as though it's going to teach us how to be prepared for whatever disaster appears there. It's like that in zombie shows, right? Yeah. It's like that the zombie show is how to hunker down and protect yourself from contagion.
Right.
But these are not good examples, if only because they take the worst case example, the worst case scenario as the only case scenario.
Right.
And so when we look at movies like Contagion, we see the collapse of social order. We see the collapse of people's ability or willingness to help one another. We see the health system collapse. And while that could be a little bit instructive insofar as like when people told us flatten the curve here, that might be what people were imagining.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have seen and what is genuinely surprising, as I said, is this resilience.
Right.
And this resilience granted, it's starting to crack apart a little bit as people have been hunkered down a little bit too much, but there's resilience, this willingness and ability to try to engage the worlds of their experience differently, to stay home rather than going out, not for oneself, but for the sake of others.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of in the early stages of in March, there was a survey that was done that showed that Canadians, whilst many were concerned for their own health, but let's say about 60%, I'm not remembering the numbers exactly, but were concerned about themselves and their own health, the vast majority were more concerned about vulnerable people that they knew and about helping to keep them safe. And so were willing to sort of adapt their social lives for this. Mm-hmm. Economic resilience. Now, this click and collect kind of culture, right? The curbside stuff, the online shopping and so forth, that was already part of our framework, but not with everything. Now, looking at the ways that, for example, in Kitchener-Waterloo, the farmers market, you know, St. Jacob's Farmers Market or the Kitchener Farmers Market, places that a lot of us like to frequent because of the actual tactile experience, the experience of the crowd. Well, you're seeing the resilience of this idea of how they can put together these businesses so that people can still access it, so it doesn't have to simply go under. Mm-hmm. Or restaurants doing pop-ups for people to pick up things.
Mm-hmm.
An example of this is a place called Lana's Lounge. It's just across King Street from the university. And I'm referencing it for everybody who misses the campus. So Lana's Lounge has a thing where you go and you pick up dinner, and then you go online, and the bands that they would normally have playing, blues bands generally, are there. So you're all eating together. You're having this experience of watching this band. So it's a creative way of trying to reproduce, obviously inadequately, but to reproduce something of the feeling of collectivity.
Right.
Also resilience, and I'm going to do a shout out to my students here, because I was teaching, as I said to you earlier, fourth year seminars, and I had an incredible resilience in students who were able, even under very difficult circumstances, to nonetheless carry on the work that needed to be done to get that, whatever you needed to get the course.
Right.
But the level of, and quality of conversation, the resilience of a generation, Gen Z has, or even the millennials have been told, you're not resilient, you know, your helicopter parents have ruined you.
Yes.
Absolutely and fundamentally disagree. Having watched a generation of folks who have actually managed with grace and elan a crisis that none of their parents or grandparents had to ever experience.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another pleasant surprise. The grace and the generosity that people have for one another is something I think that is well worth noting. And that, I'm not going to lie, was a big surprise.
Well, I think that's good and surprising, I'm sure, for a lot of people to hear once this gets out there. But I think that's a great thing to take away is the collectivism. I feel like we've seen Canadians, specifically in the Canadian context I'm talking about, really come together right now. And of course, we see it on CBC. They did the Blue Rodeo sing-along. It's a feel good thing. And it does make us feel like we're doing this for everyone. It's not just for ourselves.
Right. And granted, you know, people are starting to get tired. We're many mm-hmm. days into this yes. experience. People are really, especially with the nice weather mm-hmm. and with the little signals coming from different provincial, the federal and provincial governments that right. maybe something might be changing. But I would like to say that it's like that there was a sense of solidarity. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, people went from social distancing to, which was really the public health language that had right. been used since 2009. It was that concept was came out of the 2009 H1N1 right. outbreak, right? Pandemic. To physical distancing, but social solidarity. And that this idea that vulnerable people, and among us, vulnerable people, some of my colleagues are those vulnerable people. Some of my students were not those vulnerable people, that we had to find a way of trying to engage that. And again, I don't want to sound too idealistic or utopian in this mm-hmm. because we've seen some pretty dastardly things too.
Yeah.
We've seen, the depths that people will go to, the scams and the hucksters and the people mm-hmm. selling snake oil, that we've seen that side too. But we've seen a lot less of that than I think I was expecting.
Mm-hmm. What are you making of the protests going on at Queen's Park, the anti-lockdown protesters? What are mm-hmm. your thoughts on that?
I think that we live in a time where we are experiencing a conflict between mm-hmm. value sets. For a very long time, responsibility has been individualized. This is the neoliberal model of everything. Mm-hmm. It's your education, you as an individual are responsible. Your family, you as an individual are responsible. Your health, you as an individual are responsible. Mm-hmm. Everything that we do has been really sort of framed in this sort of privatized, individualized kind of social, economic, and political framework, right? And this is a reality. I'm sure it's nothing new. Everybody who studies in the Faculty of Arts at Laurier has yes. heard about neoliberalism. So on the one hand, that we are told as individuals that we live in a culture of self-help. That all you have to do is go to any bookstore. Okay, when you can go to a bookstore again. That it's the self-help shelves are massive. Yeah. And the reason for that is because we're charged with finding expertise, with evaluating for ourselves, and of being consumers of everything. Consumers of health, consumers of products, consumers of our everyday lives. So right. I suppose that has sort of been the key. Coming up against this is this demand for collectivism.
Mm-hmm.
And public health crises like this demand that we consider the collective good, that we have to think about these things. Now, the collision of these two things, I think, is something that we're seeing in these protests.
Right.
And I think that we're seeing the ways that people have tried to come to terms with the individualization of the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
It manifests in some of the conspiracy theories, if you will, that drive some presence there.
Right.
Or some of the rugged individualism, and it's like really much more of an American version of identity
yes.
that we, because we're so close to the United States, we're seeing it. This idea is, I'm an individual, you can't tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's that is part of our public discourse. But the conspiracy theories are often really driven by, you know, this demand to find out for yourself, to do your own research, to think for yourself, to be skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And those conspiracy theories are something that should cause us obviously concern, yeah. but also on the other side should cause us to reflect on what reasons people have. So not to just say to condemn the conspiracy theories,
mm-hmm.
not to believe the conspiracy theories, and I'm not saying that, but not to condemn them outright, but to try to understand the place that they come from.
Right.
Like, what do conspiracy theories desire? When you're looking at those protests, let's say at Queen's Park, and you see that there's a sign that says this has all been caused by the 5G network, you should ask, what is it that conspiracy theory desires?
Mm-hmm.
It desires control. It desires certainty. It desires knowledge about mm-hmm. about a world. And mostly it desires the demand, an idea of having control over what it is that is happening. No one in this moment has control over what's going on. That the only thing that has control at this point in time is the virus. Yeah. And the virus is not a person. Let's not anthropomorphize it. It is not a person. It doesn't think. It doesn't plan. It doesn't plot against us. It doesn't lie in wait. Those are all the ways that we come to try to understand and to narrativize what it's about.
Okay.
The virus itself is indifferent to all of the explanatory frameworks that we could bring to bear on it.
Mm-hmm.
But to think about what it is that, well, you know, why is it that at a particular juncture that people are willing to buy into conspiracy theories like Pizzagate? Or the idea that this is a virus that was concocted in a lab. It speaks a lot to people's suspicion and a feeling of a lack of control.
Right.
And rather than, I say, just dismissing it, that we should be trying to think about all of the different ways that we organize ourselves that make a lot of us feel like we have no control.
Absolutely.
And in this moment, it really brings it to a head.
Now, with relation to that, I want to talk a little bit about kind of your reactions about the public's reactions to the pandemic. Was this surprising to you? Was it predictable? I know you wanted to talk a little bit about anxiety culture, so maybe this is a good time to kind of segue into that.
I have to say, again, the solidarity, the idea of conviviality, this idea that we're all in this together kind of thing, that did genuinely surprise me because of some of those neoliberal factors that I talked about. It's like, you can't just go from being a consumer of health to being somebody who is told what to do for the greater good, from the individual to the collective. So that did surprise me. What also surprised me was the ways in which people responded to the information of health. And again, what surprised me was that it's actually pretty predictable. And this is part of health communication. One of the concerns that they have is that some people absolutely over-identify with a message and say, I'm not ever going outside again. Everything is dangerous. You know, I'm going to change my habits. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. There's some people who over-identify with messages to the point that they are almost paralyzed in their decision-making.
Right.
Others, on the other hand, completely disidentify. Not me, not here, not now. This is something I talk about with my students, the not me, not here, not now. Ways that we have of rationalizing how we're not actually part of the narrative that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's not me. It's vulnerable populations. It's not here. It's in New York City. It's in London. It's in Lombardy in Italy. Not now. It's like, I'm young. It's not going to affect me. Or that not now is sort of a way of saying that they said that even the not now is like, this is a fake virus. It's not real. Right. But so the ways that people have absolutely disidentifying are also very significant, because what really in public health, you want people sort of in the middle. You want people who can sort of respond to the information of health and of public health in sort of rational ways that enable them to actually take some control and to understand what they need to do. But to produce that is something that they have not yet mastered. I'm not going to lie. It's like part of public health is this push and pull between extremes, trying to find the ways to communicate with a population that may be both maybe resistant, may over-identify and be subjected to anxiety. You want to be able to provide a message that is both not alarming, but producing enough alarm that there's a call to action is what they call it. The call to action, do something, wash your hands, don't touch your face, keep socially distant, right? Wear a mask. That this is one of the challenges, is that finding that sweet spot. And I think that what was not surprising is that we have those extremes. But what is surprising, I think, is that people have responded pretty well to the information and to the understanding, the difficulty of understanding the science of this stuff. The science of this stuff is not easy. A lot of it is new, despite the fact that there was experience with SARS in 2003. A lot of this is incredibly new. People are now utilizing language that is and pertains to, and they understand this language in very important ways, flattening the curve. looking at the graphs and being able to sort of read those. You know, scientific literacy is not, and health literacy is not great in Canada. Mm-hmm. Studies have shown that the majority of people don't have great access to that literacy, particularly those that don't have post-secondary education. And yet we've watched as, you know, some of our some politicians, our public health officers have done a really, I think, a good job of explaining a lot of this stuff. But what they're not good at explaining is the uncertainty. And that's where we're starting to get people chomping at the bit, because it's like, what do you mean we're not doing this? What do you mean we're not doing this? Because people want certainty. They want to know what the outcome of this is going to be. They want to know, when's the vaccine coming? Well, it's not likely coming anytime soon. Mm-hmm. When are classes going to be open? Well, how do we do that safely when we don't actually know what this summer is going to bring?
Right.
These are some of the issues, right?
Now, I think we can link that whole concept of anxiety culture to the conspiracy theories that I'm so interested in hearing your take on. So, of course, lately there's been numerous conspiracy theories flying around the internet about the pandemic, where it came from. There's some saying that this is manufactured from a lab in China, while others are circulating this video called The Plandemic, which was widely discredited. So obviously trying times like these only increase anxieties about what's going on, which kind of allow people to fall into theories like this. So what are the implications of conspiracy theories like this going around?
Well, I think that one of the big concerns and one of the big flags here should be the kind of skepticism that people have and the distrust they have in our public officials, in public health officials, in the establishment, even establishment medicine.
Right.
This is not new, but it feeds into so many other sort of pre-existing conspiracy theories. So let's take the 5G conspiracy theory. That's the one I find the most remarkable, and it's like a greater than flat earthers kind of way. The idea that, you know, that this virus has been around, and once they flipped on the on 5G, that this was, it just, it mobilized it and is making people sick. One of the shocking things about this is, of course, that it seems like it's so desperately implausible, but it does. What's not shocking is that it feeds into pre-existing conspiracy theories that existed with regard to the relationship between North America and China. We can look at the American political scene, the tensions with China that pre-existed. So one thing feeds into that and helps to explain and justify that.
Right.
The second thing, we have been talking about and panicking about electronic devices and electromagnetic fields and electromagnetic smog for a very long time. In fact, when I first started teaching my risk communication course in 2003, we talked about electromagnetic fields and the antennas going up. This was before everybody had a cell phone, like, right? Before everybody had a cell phone. And the conspiracy theories around this were, you know, if it wasn't a horrible thing, why do they put these antennas up on schools and churches and in these places and cover them up to make them look like trees? They're hiding them, okay? Or they're hiding the data that we need about connections between electromagnetic fields and cancer, or between electromagnetic fields and attention deficit disorder. And we've got a long history of those sorts of things. You know, we can think of it like most recently, you know, nomophobia. Are you familiar with nomophobia?
No, I'm not.
Nomophobia is, we started out as a joke diagnosis for the anxiety that people have when they're either the battery on their phone is dying or they've forgotten or lost their phone. Nomophobia being a thing. It has now turned into a real diagnosis. That is like, you know, you can't make this stuff up. So it was first a joke and now it's a serious thing. We've been talking about our concern about, you know, social interaction and our students and how they're all distracted in class. We've been talking about and building sort of panics and technology panics around cell phones for a long time. So no surprise that this just feeds into different prongs of exactly those panics that pre-exist, and actually help to sort of take those panics and extend them into new domains as explanatory frameworks. And as an explanatory framework, it's a way of talking about, you know, about a kind of anxiety. And mm-hmm. maybe it's and the thing about anxiety is that it doesn't have a definite object. Right. Anxiety moves from thing to thing to thing to thing. It's not like fear. Fear is something as of an object, of something in particular. Anxiety is free-floating, and it can be attached to various things. We live in a world where it seems like we're infinitely substitutable risks,
right,
and infinitely substitutable anxieties. So right now, 5G or the deep state. Now, here's this as like the QAnon deep state. This is a fake virus conspiracy theory. Yeah. Is one that also has precursors. It has mm-hmm. a history. You know, those same people who talk about Roswell and you know that crashed, aliens and crashed UFOs and how the government isn't telling us everything. This actually is not a new kind of concept. These conspiracy theories that suggest that there's a lack of trust in government
right.
are not new. And they're not left or right. They're nonpartisan. They exist on both sides in almost equal measure. And that they find they're manifested in really sort of significant ways at moments of uncertainty.
Right.
So conspiracy theories and uncertainty go hand in hand. Now, post 9/11 conspiracy theories came after 9/11 as a sort of an after effect of those.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm just thinking what you mentioned earlier about scientific literacy. Do you think there's a linkage between these believers in conspiracies and a lack thereof of overall scientific literacy for everyone? Like it is very hard to understand and to be well-versed right now in the complexities of what's going on. So do you think... Mm-hmm. scientific mm-hmm. literacy improving for everyone would kind of decrease the belief in the spread of these conspiracy theories?
I think with certain ones, even those who are scientifically literate can be prone to believing in conspiracy theories. And I'm not going to lie, I enjoy myself a good conspiracy theory.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't, right? And it's like there's something enthralling about them. But I have to say that education is a means of challenging what are called cognitive biases. And I'm sure you've heard of these. You know, so these are these sort of mental shortcuts that we use to explain the world. And those cognitive biases often are ways that we sort of manage the world around us. Like those cognitive biases, when you're looking at particular behaviors around you, it's a shortcut to say, don't cross the road right now, you might get hit.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, however, cognitive biases are the ways that we sort of process information that they become these sort of ingrained moments of understanding the world. And if your world isn't challenged, if you're not confronted with something that is opposing, it is really easy to fall into certain of these biases. So one of these biases is something known as the explanatory depth bias. And here's one. That is the bias where you think you know more than you actually know.
Yes. Right?
And I know that so we're all prone to that one, definitely, where it's sort of this idea that the way of interpreting the world, that I have many experiences, that I know these things, and I've been doing my research online, I've been doing it for myself, because everybody's been telling me, do your research, I've done it, and the only thing that I've confirmed in there is that I know more because I know QAnon and I know how to read the code. That's one of them, right?
Right.
Another one is the confirmation bias, right? What you go into, what you're already skeptical about, what you already doubt, what you already know about the world or believe you know about the world,
mm-hmm.
is something that you reproduce in the conspiracy theory. And what this is like the conspiracy theory. So let's imagine I don't trust the government. Ergo, the government is making this up. Those two things, that becomes part of the confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
So we reconfirm the things that we already know. So I would say education, scientific literacy being a significant part of this, rather than just the fear that we have of science,
mm-hmm.
that we need to be able to learn how to engage science and to engage a way of knowing the world that is not comfortable and is not easy. Science, for those people who are not studying science, is not easy. I'm going to say on the other way around, for the sciences, studying and engaging some of the stuff that you engage in the Faculty of Arts or social science is also not comfortable because it mm-hmm. challenges preconceived ideas and notions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the third bias is known as the causal illusion bias, and that is that X causes Y just because they happen at the same time. right? And this is, as I just like, there's no connection between 5G and a virus. It's so utterly implausible.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, 5G is turned on in China at the in China in the region around Wuhan, purportedly, at the end of November, and a virus emerges. So you see, this is one of the challenges we have, is that we get into these sort of shortcuts for thinking. And what we need to be able to do is to be more patient with our thinking and to challenge our preconceived notions or ideas about the world. And that's not easy to do. And it's especially not easy to do in a moment of crisis. No one wants to be challenged in a moment of crisis. We need the comforts and the certainties. And I would say that this is what it feeds into. It's sort of that people are looking for the comfort of, even, you know, we can't control the virus, but we can control the narrative around it.
Yeah.
It came from here. It's causing this. It's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
That is really something that we need to engage. It's sort of like, what does it mean to be able to tolerate uncertainty? I don't know about you, but I'm not very good at it myself. But I can conceptualize what it might possibly mean and how we might patiently engage this stuff to try to really understand what the stakes are of what it is that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
We also have explanations, implausible maybe, that come to the fore that are just easier than the story is. Science is based in something that is known as, like, is called falsifiability.
Right.
You put anything out there and it's always up for grabs. There is no knowledge that is absolutely and utterly certain. There are knowledges that stick around for a time, but nothing is absolutely certain. It's always subjected to testing and retesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we could take elsewhere some of the lessons of that to try to think differently about our world, if we could develop that kind of patience and that kind of willingness to say, I'm not, there's no absolute certainty, then we might be able to engage this differently.
Right.
It is not the human lot, however.
Now, is this the first pandemic where we've seen such a multitude of conspiracy theories and misinformation, or have we seen this before in previous health crises? Because it just seems so heightened right now, and I don't know if that's to do with the modern digital age and how easy it is to disperse these ideas online in relation to public health. Is this unprecedented, or?
I will have to say that the dissemination is probably wider because of our new communication technologies, but they are not new. For example, we have explanatory frameworks that come out of the Judeo-Christian Bible to explain, for example, a plague of locusts, right? Stories about other risk scenarios, about floods, you know? So this is not new. We can also say, in looking back at other pandemics, the bubonic plague, you know, there were stories that circulated during the Great Plague in Europe that really halved the population of Europe.
Right.
And there were stories that were, for example, that it was caused by Jewish people poisoning wells. So it fit into a narrative of xenophobia, of anti-Semitism that already existed within the European context. And we see an economy of blame. Let's blame this. So they must be poisoning us. This is not unlike ideas that we can see circulating and connected to the sort of racism and xenophobia that is directed at Asian folks right now, that they must be somehow to blame for this. So it's not new. And I would say, in fact, one of the things that sort of premises my teaching is that we're really bad at coming up with new ways of telling stories. That we repeat sort of the same narrative frames, the same ideas of, you know, of good versus bad, good versus evil, that we seem to reproduce these. And the idea that someone must be to blame, whether it's a deity or a group of people that we can identify and single out, that is, again, it's not a new phenomenon. And it really does, is something that persists over time. Now, let's go back to the Spanish flu, 1918, 1919. More people died of the Spanish flu than died in World War I. Okay, this is a fact. Significantly more people died, particularly over the time of the pandemic. Now, at this point, you know, as I said, there were all sorts of narratives that fit into that particular historical moment. One was that it was a form of biological warfare that the Germans had given to the Americans by and dumped by means of U-boats. Another one was that it was caused by the Germans, but not brought by U-boats, but caused by Bayer aspirin. To Bayer, right? It's a German company.
Wow.
So it must be the Germans doing this to us. Mm-hmm. And that somehow the aspirin caused it. And there was some evidence that maybe certain people were their symptoms were exacerbated by taking that aspirin. But that's a very different story. And I'm not going to litigate that one in court. Right. however, on the other side, the Germans had suggested that almost an exactly similar thing. Had suggested that the Americans had somehow tainted a water supply or had mm-hmm. sort of seeded the pandemic. Now, this is kind of interesting. So they don't know exactly where the virus came from, but it likely came from, one of the theories is it likely came from a pig farm in mm-hmm. Wisconsin.
Wow.
Right? Does not, you know, it's like, and how did it come there? Because pigs are genetically similar to humans, and that we tend to trade viruses back and forth. That's why they call them swine flus, right? Right. Sort of, and that's it. So this one is like this. Yeah, you think of COVID-19, and mm-hmm. it's like, okay, the disease is caused by the novel coronavirus 2 that has been passed from one species, likely a bat, they're saying. They think they found the reservoir or the source of it, and passed through, and it's our interactions with animals. And our interactions with animals can be problematic. You think of factory farming. Those are desperately nasty places for diseases to mix and admix. The AIDS crisis. There were lots of theories. There were theories that it was tainted poppers, which were drugs that were taken in discos in North America, that it was a form of Legionnaire's disease, so coming from the air conditioning systems, or it was a KGB plot, right? That it was planted by the KGB, or that it was the FBI trying to get rid of the gay pop. Like, again, we're not, these conspiracy theories are not new, mm-hmm. and they have are sort of different ways of engaging and thinking about mm-hmm. the ways and sort of what people are most insecure about.
Right.
They fit into existing political, social, economic narratives, right? So mm-hmm. you can think of the homophobia of the 1980s mapped really easily onto a conspiracy theory. That would tie into the gay community in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Coronavirus fits into pre-existing suspicions about China and about right. its political system and about a great concern about our economic dependence on China as well. Mm-hmm. Even though we want the cheap stuff that's produced in China, but mm-hmm. then we don't want the economic fallout of that. So the explanation becomes that this is that, you know, that that anxiety fits there. Mm-hmm. So we have to think about, you know, what do our conspiracy theories, and when I say it's a weird way of saying it, what do our conspiracy theories want? Well, they want an explanation that mm-hmm. not only explains the anxiety or the insecurity around a particular event, but also helps to explain other insecurities that pre-exist.
Hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of what I've been reading about these conspiracy theories, exactly what you said, it's taking comfort in kind of the ability to control the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of these theories, like we've touched on, come from xenophobia, going back to the Spanish flu and...
Yeah.
Now, a lot of these that we're seeing right now hold racist beliefs and root themselves in an anti-Asian and Chinese rhetoric.
Right.
So what are some ways right now that we can stand in solidarity with the Asian community?
Well, this is a challenge because on the one hand, we don't want a response to help people to over-identify the Asian community with this disease.
Right.
And that's a big thing. It's like, again, identifying a disease as belonging to a group of people is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So disidentifying with it is going to be part of it. Being allies, you know, there was a survey that was done again in the middle of March that suggested that people were more afraid to sit next to an Asian person on public transit than they were of actually even contracting the disease. Wow. Now, scratch your head at that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is that this is the way that people respond. It's too easy to blame people for what is actually ultimately both a natural process and a process that is a result of the ways that we organize ourselves economically. And mm-hmm. really, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. This is a Mark Fisher's thing. It's like that. It's like it's much easier. But I think that, you know, one of the challenges that we have is to be able to unpack and to uncouple the connection between Asia and this microbe, to remember that the Spanish flu likely came from the United States. And it's part of our practices too. It's mm-hmm. easy to say those practices are at fault. Than it is to say, to turn and take a look at the ways that we engage the world around us, that our absolute gluttony for meat, for example, and I'm saying this as a carnivore, so please no letters to the radio station. All right, it's like, that our gluttony for meat, that we eat approximately 60% more meat in this day and age than they mm-hmm. did in the 1950s, when meat and potatoes were a staple of life.
Right.
Okay, we eat significantly more. That our factory farming, for example, is something we should be targeting rather than individuals. Mm-hmm. Factory farming and our own relationship, our own responsibility for this overconsumption of meat. Or we can think about, you know, there's another anxiety that's out there. It's a global interconnectedness, right? So mm-hmm. somebody who's got a virus gets on a plane and they come here. How about stopping taking for granted the immediate and ease of access to all parts of the world mm-hmm. that we've seen are part of the problem, right? That is, they're part of the larger problem. The problem of climate change is one we haven't even broached on here. Pandemics and climate change go hand in hand. And the less that we actually, and the practices that lead to and encourage and exacerbate climate change are exactly the practices that exacerbate and create opportunities for pandemics to emerge, right? So mm-hmm. if thinking about these things, it's easier to say that person is responsible in an economy of blame than to mm-hmm. say, wait, my practices, the microcosm that is me is actually mm-hmm. responsible in some way too. It's easier to project it outward than it is inward. So as allies, we need to be thinking about those broader social and economic things. We've got an opportunity. I'm not saying kill capitalism. No, that's not what I'm saying. Because I honestly think that too many people are too invested literally and figuratively in it. Mm-hmm. But we do have an opportunity to change or at least tweak certain moments. Right. To think about, for example, the stakes of global travel. And, you know, to think about what that does to the environment. To think about maybe, do you need to go on a cruise? So ecologically unsound, do you really need to do that? Mm-hmm. Especially because it's like it could be a death ship.
Yeah, right? Seriously.
But other practices as well, like thinking about the ways that we engage, you know, the demand for strawberries year round or for pineapples year round. Like what mm-hmm. there's a lot of stuff that we take for granted in our consumer mm-hmm. culture that we could actually easily change. And that would possibly mean that we don't encounter in the same way these sorts of things. But individual responsibility rather than blaming a group of people, absolutely fundamental. Diseases happen. We don't blame people for the seasonal flu.
Right.
We don't blame them for colds. And here, interesting, fun fact, the common cold is, at least one version of it, is a version of coronavirus.
Wow.
What this suggests to me, and again, what this suggests to me is that once upon a time, a very, very long time ago, mm-hmm. the human species encountered a virus like this, and it mutated, and it became the cold, right? So to be able to understand it, to understand that this, while this is a world historical moment, like this is nothing, this is so unprecedented. Mm-hmm. So unprecedented to shut everything down. Even in war, things aren't shut down like this.
Right.
That this global historical moment should give us pause to really think about these stakes. viruses don't belong to people. Mm-hmm. Viruses do, however, affect some people disproportionately. Rather than focusing on and blaming a group of people, we should be more concerned with people who live in poverty, in urban inner cities, mm-hmm. Who are more prone because of their employment mm-hmm. to be exposed to the virus.
Yeah.
So maybe to be able to sort of intervene in the narrative that takes the easy and frankly really lazy route to say this group of people is responsible for this.
Yeah, I think that kind of brings me to where I wanted to wrap up here is like, if there's one kind of piece of advice for the public to follow or one piece of advice you could impart on the people listening to this program right now, what would it mm-hmm. be? Like you said, shed some great lights on kind of habitual practices of going on right. cruises and the consumer culture that we live in. Like how can we maybe take one good thing from this pandemic and move mm-hmm. forward and kind of mutate with it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the one thing that sort of strikes me, and because I've been asked this a couple of times in different interviews, and it's sort of like, you know, what's the one takeaway that I want people to have? Mm-hmm. And I usually end up with the seeming trite platitude of we're all in this together. And yet we are all in this together, and trying to think about the ways that we as individuals are really tied up with the collective activities around us mm-hmm. and vice versa, to recognize our interconnection, our interrelation, and also as a result of this, our incredible responsibility. We spent a lot of time being responsible for ourselves, being told that we had to be responsible for ourselves in this neoliberal sort of context. We have an opportunity to try to imagine our engagements, our collective and our solidarities mm-hmm. to understand how it is that we can engage the world around us in different ways. That doesn't mean that you're not going to be able to do the things that you want to do, but to understand the implications of what it is that we're doing mm-hmm. and how it actually does affect people, animals, and cultures. One final thing, remember, without artists, none of us would have gotten through this.
This is
value
true.
The arts, because without them, without those live streams, without the movies, without the music, without even chefs teaching us how to cook online,
mm-hmm.
none of us in this and are very, very, you know, we take for granted how really well we have it off, most of us in Canada, not everyone. Remember the artists,
mm-hmm.
and we have devalued them for a very long time. Maybe it's time to revalue them.
I think that's a great point to kind of send everybody off with, because that is true. So many Canadian artists especially have banded together mm-hmm. to try to make this easier for everybody, and we mm-hmm. should be celebrating them now and post-pandemic when everything gets back to normal.
Yeah. Remember, we need them.
We yeah. do. Dr. Ironstone, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so informative.
And it's been absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you so much. And I wish you all
again,
the best.
Shout out to my students. Shout out to my fourth year students. I missed you.
Oh, we'll make sure that they hear this.
Okay.
Take care, Dr. Ironstone.
Take care.
In Conversation with Radio Laurier is written and produced by Amelia Mola-Schmidt. Our song that we use for the podcast is called Dub Eastern by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.